The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hi, welcome everybody. Let's see. So I wanted to start by, can everyone hear me okay at this volume? I wanted to start off by just reviewing broadly what this talk will cover. There are many aspects of disability and many ways to approach talking about it. There can be a clinical, medical, or technical aspect. There's a cultural or anthropological aspect. There can also be a deeply personal aspect in which an individual's disability is very much wrapped up in the sensuous experience of their unique identity. This talk, however, is based upon a somewhat different aspect. It is a political, economic, and historical analysis of disability. In particular, this talk is about the modern understanding and definition of disability, which emerged alongside the modern system of capitalism itself. Although a vast spectrum of physical and mental attributes, abilities, and impairments have always been an inextricable component and part of the human species, it was only quite recently that we see the creation of a legal, political, and economic category or subgroup of humans collectively identified as disabled. Now, Karl Marx, of course, is recognized for his examination of the nature and origins of the capitalist phase of human history. And since the phenomenon of disablement arises with capitalism, it should come as no surprise that there is much in Marx's analysis of capitalism that is indispensable to the elaboration of a complete understanding of disability. There are few people who have directly engaged in the development of such an understanding, and in my opinion, the most important and groundbreaking of these was Marta Russell. And it is her writings which inform the analysis laid out in the talk. Marta Russell was not the first to explore the connection between capitalism and disability, or the notion that disability itself is a form of oppression conditioned by the historical material circumstances of society. Rather, I think her genius resides in the scope and depth with which she analyzed and studied the phenomenon. In particular, Russell went further than anyone else in specifically rooting disability oppression under capitalism in explicitly Marxist terms. For Russell, the oppression of disabled people in the modern capitalist world is no mere historical accident or tangential symptom of the dominant social system. Rather, capitalism and disability are structurally and necessarily linked in a dialectical process of mutual creation and reinforcement. Utilizing Marx's concepts regarding the nature of wage labor, exploitation, the rate of profit, and the reserve army of labor, Russell identified the oppression of disabled people as an inextricable component of the operation of the mode of production itself. So I just wanted to give a brief biographical description of Marta Russell for those who are not familiar with her. Marta Russell was born in 1951 and died just a few years ago in 2013. She grew up in Mississippi and as a young adult was involved in the 1960s civil rights movement against racial segregation. Though Russell was born with cerebral palsy and connected mobility impairments, she did not at the time think of disability in political terms, nor in connection with the struggle for civil rights taking place around her. In fact, it wasn't until many years later that such thoughts crossed her mind. Russell moved to Los Angeles, California in the mid-1970s, where she began a career working in the film industry, and shortly thereafter, raising a daughter. In the late 1980s, Russell developed further mobility impairments, and she began to use a wheelchair. Before long, she found it increasingly difficult to continue working in the film industry, and eventually came to rely on Social Security disability insurance payments as a means of supporting herself and her child. Slowly, Russell began meeting more disabled people, and in particular, more disabled activists, who introduced her to the notion of disability as a political concept. She became involved with disability activist organizations, such as ADAPT and Not Dead Yet. She continued her activism with the ACLU, participated in the movement against the war in Iraq, and she simultaneously developed her political ideology at a very rapid pace. She engaged in extensive studies of the works of Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Angela Davis, Karl Marx, and numerous others. And in 1998, she published her first and only book titled Beyond Ramps. She spent the next 10 years or so further developing, refining, and reformulating her arguments on the nature of disability oppression under capitalism. So before getting into the theoretical element of the talk, just to make sure we're on the same page, just want to go through some basic statistics, take a look at what disability looks like today in the U.S. So there are about 64 million disabled people in the U.S., or 20% of the population, and roughly half that number are those with a severe disability. For women, the percentage is 25% who have a disability. For black people, it is 30%. And for LGBT people, it is around 36%. The leading cause of disability in the US is currently neuropsychiatric conditions. And 36% of all disabled people acquire their disabling condition from a work-related injury or illness. The poverty rate for people with disabilities is roughly 30%. 40% of all homeless people are disabled. The unemployment rate for disabled people is 73%. And that includes those who are actively looking for work or those who report they would prefer to work but aren't. Disabled individuals are also twice as likely as non-disabled individuals to be the victim of violence and three times as likely to be the target of sexual assault. 40% of women with disabilities experience domestic or spousal abuse, which is higher than the already high rate of 25% for all women. 50% of all people killed by the police annually in the U.S. have a disability, half of whom have a mental disability or illness. And of all those currently incarcerated in state prisons across the U.S., 73% of women and 55% of men have some sort of a mental health disability. So clearly that paints a pretty dire picture, I would say. But again, it depends on how you interpret the numbers. And, I don't think it will necessarily surprise anyone here that the prevailing interpretation in our society is not one that identifies all this as a form of systemic oppression resulting from the dominant social system. Indeed, for much of our recent history, the ruling ideas around disability have been quite different. These ideas essentially hold that the inferior, perhaps even pitiable condition endured by disabled people is a function of their individual misfortune. At best, this might mean that a disabled person is deserving of charity, since you know they can't be blamed for having been just dealt a bad hand in life. At worst, it can mean that a disabled person has no claim to a better life, because it is in the natural order of things that the fittest, you know, should whatever rise to the top at the expense of the least fit. But what both these positions share is an assumption that the original source of the inferior living conditions is located in the individual's physiology rather than in the surrounding social system. And, you know, this is the way, of course, that the liberal and conservative wings of the capitalist class talk about many aspects of this society, right? If someone is poor, it's either because of some unfortunate accident that may have befallen them, and you know, therefore they should be offered a hand up. Or on the other hand, it's because of some fault of their own, you know, lacking a good work ethic or whatever. For in disability, this has meant that a lot of the historical focus on disability has been of a rehabilitative or philanthropic variety. Right, the idea is that if medicine or technology could simply help the blind to see, the deaf to hear, the depressed person to think happier thoughts, then the problem would go away. Or perhaps if the disabled had access to charitable funds, they would be able to more effectively compete on the marketplace of modern life. Now, I don't agree with that, but just to be clear, I think that we should absolutely support everything and anything which in any way would make any human's life better, more livable, according to their desires and wishes. And, you know, and that includes medical breakthroughs, technological and prosthetic advancements, pharmaceuticals which provide relief, financial assistance to buy necessary commodities, and so on. You know, I think that we should be, for all of this and more, being as widely available as possible to those who want it. The problem, simply, is that as long as the basic relations, inequalities, and the economic culture of capitalism remains intact, disabled people will continue to exist as an oppressed subgroup. I just wanted to quote from another of my favorite theoreticians on the subject. This is socialist disability advocate Helen Keller, who wrote an article about this phenomenon over 100 years ago. She writes, she wrote this in a magazine called Outlook. It was a magazine for blind people. And it was on the topic of unemployment. And she writes, "We have been accustomed to regard the unemployed deaf and blind as victims of their infirmities. That is to say, we have supposed that if their sight and hearing were miraculously restored, they would find work. But I wish to suggest that the unemployment of the blind is only part of a greater problem. There are, it is estimated, 1 million laborers out of work in the United States. Their inaction is not due to physical disabilities or lack of ability or of intelligence or to ill health or vice. It is due to the fact that our present system of production necessitates a large margin of idle people. The business world in which we live cannot give everyone opportunity to fulfill their capabilities or even assure them continuous occupation as an unskilled laborer. The means of employment are in the hands of a minority of people and are used to increase owners' profits rather than keeping all people busy and productive. Thus, it has come to pass that in this land of plenty, there is an increasing number of, quote, superfluous people. In a small corner of this vast social distress, we find our unemployed blind. Their lack of sight is not the primary cause of their idleness. It is a contributing cause. It relegates them to the enormous army of the unwillingly idle." And I like this quote also, and I chose to share it, because I think it helps to illuminate the fact that there is an historical tradition of socialists who have put forth a counter-analysis to that of the ruling reformist or rehabilitative position. In the 1930s, there was another group of left-wing disabled activists called the League of the Physically Handicapped that wrote important documents along this line. Later in the 1970s and 80s, a group of disabled socialist activists in Britain organized around a theory of disability that would come to be referred to as the social model of disability. And the social model represented the clearest attempt yet to place disablement in an historical and materialist context. It affirmed the notion that the oppression of disabled people was a function of the external social environment rather than any inherent shortcomings of the disabled individual themselves. Michael Oliver, who coined the phrase social model of disability, writes in his book, The Politics of Disablement, the ideological construction of the individual was rooted in history. Marx wrote, the further back we go into history, the more the individual, and therefore the producing individual, seems to depend on and constitute a part of a larger whole. At first, it is quite naturally the family and the clan, which is but an enlarged family. Later on, it is the community. And this is Michael Oliver. Hence, individuals always existed, but only as part of larger social groupings, whether they be families, clans, or communities. It was only with the rise of the Industrial Revolution that the isolated private individual appears on the historical stage. The idea of disability as an individual pathology only becomes possible when we have an idea of individual able-bodiedness. The contemporary concept of disability is clearly linked to the rise of industrial capitalism and the development of wage labor, which required a specific kind of individual, namely one able to operate dangerous machinery in the factories in competition with their peers. Prior to this, individuals, whether with impairments or otherwise, had worked cooperatively within the family, the community, or the clan. Although ignorance and prejudice were not uncommon, and differences in individual contributions noted, individuals were rarely segregated from everyday life as a result of difference in performance. The social model, I think clearly is an inherently progressive, radical thesis that we, I think, can utilize. I don't know that I would call it a fully worked out Marxist theory, per se. I think it certainly leans on a number of Marxist concepts, but I think in the hands of both its originators and contemporary proponents, I think it is intentionally somewhat of a broad, somewhat ambiguous framework. I think it was intended to be utilized by those with a variety of political ideologies. What it therefore possesses in breadth, I think it can lack to a certain degree in depth and precision. This brings me to the theoretical contribution of Martha Russell, who I think takes things further. I'm going to start by just summarizing what I think are four key points that Martha Russell makes, and then I will try to explain them in greater detail. So the first is that she argues that the prevailing rate of the exploitation of labor determines who is disabled and who is not at a given point in history. The second point is that those whose labor falls far enough below the mean or the average in its productive capacity are considered unemployable and are removed from the active army of workers via segregation, institutionalization, or state pauperization, which is basically lifetime of poverty. Three, that the mass of humans which comprise this so-called surplus population, who live in existence in perpetual isolation, poverty, and degradation, are intended to serve as a discipline and a warning to the active working class regarding the necessity of their continued, quote, voluntary participation in the system of wage labor. And four, that the liberal civil rights approach to change actually falls far short of what is needed. In particular, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, while a very important reform, has actually had barely any impact on the economic metrics of unemployment, poverty, and homeless rates for disabled people. And that has remained constant over the past 30 years, from before its passage to after. Russell argues that this is because any approach which fails to address the actual class relations of society itself will also fail to have a significant impact on the oppressive conditions that are a product of those class relations. All right, so I think we're good on time. I'm going to read, I'm going to start with an extended quote directly from Arthur Russell. I may cut some of it if it feels like it's going on too long, but she just puts it very well, so I figured just quote her. So let's see. She's talking here about, she begins by just reviewing, sort of going over some of the basics of Marxist economics, right, which sets the basis for her to then look at how disability figures into that. So, and in the discussion, ask questions if any of this doesn't make sense, or, so this is her. Under Marx's labor theory of value, the basis of capitalist accumulation is the concept of surplus labor value. The worker's ability to work, Marx calls this labor power, is sold to the capitalist in return for a wage. The amount of labor time that the worker works to produce value equivalent to their wage, Marx calls necessary labor. The additional labor time that the worker works beyond this, Marx calls surplus labor. And the value it produces, he calls surplus value. The capitalist then, of course, appropriates this surplus value as a source of profits. Non-disabled workers have value because bosses can push them to produce at ever-increasing rates of speed and generate higher profits. As capitalism initially developed, impaired persons, whether they be deaf, blind, mentally impaired, those with mobility difficulties, were seen as less fit to do the tasks required of the wage workers, at that time mostly in factories. Industrial capitalism thus created both a class of proletarians and a class of disabled who did not conform to the standard worker body and whose labor power was therefore effectively ignored. A market-driven society meant that disabled persons perceived to be of less use to the competitive profit cycle were excluded from work. As a result, disabled persons came to be regarded as a social problem, and the justification emerged for segregating individuals with impairments from mainstream life and into a variety of institutions, including workhouses, asylums, prisons, colonies, and segregated schools. Regulating the composition of the labor force through social policy became the key to ensuring an ongoing exploitable labor supply. Disability became an important boundary category through which persons were allocated to either the work-based or the need-based system of distribution. In the United States, disability came to be defined explicitly in relation to the labor market. For instance, in many workers' compensation statutes, a laborer's body is rated according to its functioning parts. In Social Security law, disabled is literally defined as one who is medically unable to engage in work or substantial gainful activity. And this is the last chunk of her quote. Social analysts describe the disability needs-based system as a privilege because, as an administrative category, it carries with it permission to be exempt from the work-based system. In conservative terms, disability can be described as an essential part of the moral economy. In the public debate over redistribution of societal resources, public assistance is viewed as legitimate for those deemed unable to work. But the disabled individuals on public benefits under U.S. capitalism do not have any objective right to a decent standard of living, even with the so-called privileged status, nor is the definition of disability etched in stone. Rather, the definition of disability is flexible. The state, which evaluates, the state determines who's disabled, controls the labor supply by expanding or contracting the number of persons who qualify as disabled, often for political and economic reasons. I think that last point is noteworthy for demonstrating, among other things, how disability itself is also a socially constructed category. I've been thinking this weekend how when we talk about race or gender as a social construct, I think disability is similarly socially constructed. Throughout the history of the U.S., numerous impairments or conditions have been variously included and excluded from the rubric of disability. In the 1970s and 80s, both Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan drastically cut the number of people receiving disability benefits by redefining what was considered a disability. In the 1990s, Bill Clinton similarly sought to move more workers from the disability rolls into the active workforce in order to keep inflation and wage growth down as a means of extending the economic boom. As Martha Russell points out, all of this can also be understood in terms of Marx's general law of capitalist accumulation. Marx identified an economic paradox of capitalism, well, several, one of which is that as the productive powers of capitalism developed, a smaller number of workers would be able to set in motion a greater mass of productive output, even as the absolute number of human laborers increased with the general social wealth. This would lead to a constant, if not expansive, proportion of humanity being rendered superfluous or perpetually unemployed, and what Marx called the industrial reserve army of labor. The ability for the capitalist class to effectively control this reserve army thus became an important tool in its ability to control the economy and, by extension, society as a whole. Marx, I think it's in Capital, I didn't know the source, but Marx argues that the reserve army, or the what he calls the relative surplus population, includes disabled people. He writes, this class of perpetually marginalized individuals includes the demoralized and those unable to work, chiefly people who succumb to their incapacity for adaptation to capitalism due to the division of labor, people who have passed the normal age of the laborer, the victims of industry, whose number increases with the increase of dangerous machinery, of mines, chemical works, the injured, the sickly. Pauperism is the hospital of the active labor army, and it becomes the dead weight of the industrial reserve army under capitalism. Its production is included in that of the relative surplus population, its necessity in theirs. Along with the surplus population, pauperism forms a condition of capitalist production and of the capitalist development of wealth. It enters into, it's a French phrase that translates into, it enters into the incidental operating costs of capitalist production, because capitalist knows how to throw these, for the most part, from its own shoulders onto those of the working class and the lower middle class. I think that this last sentence is also borne out if you think about how funding for Social Security is disproportionately funded by working class taxes and incomes as opposed to the wealthy or corporations. And finally, Marx points out that this surplus population constitutes a group, quote, whose misery is an inverse ratio to its torment of labor. Or, as Martha Russell puts it, capitalism is a system that forces non-disabled persons into the labor market, but also just as forcefully coerces disabled persons out. Oppression occurs in either case. And I also think this is an important point to consider when thinking about the ways in which disability oppression under capitalism injures not just disabled people, but is also tied up with the oppression of the entire working class, non-disabled members of the working class. Within the capitalist form of alienated wage labor, human individuality and unique potentiality, as manifested in the differing and uneven capabilities which exist among all humans without exception, is flattened out and negated for the majority of workers. So while hyper-exaggerating the historically conditioned differences that exist between those considered disabled and non-disabled, capitalism simultaneously distorts the differences that obtain within each of these groups. As Marx writes, capitalism takes all the natural, spiritual, and social variety of individual activity out of spontaneous human labor and instead renders the worker ever more exclusively dependent on labor and on a particularly very one-sided machine-like labor at that. The worker is thus depressed spiritually and physically to the condition of a machine, and from being a human becomes an abstract activity. The content of the labor activity of those inside the active workforce is treated like a more or less identical and therefore easily replaceable resource. Individual humans are rendered abstract laborers who together comprise an undifferentiated mass of potential profit for the owners of capital to exploit. These human resources are expected to conform to a standardized and uniform pace and process of alienated production, regardless of the different effects this wear and tear has on their different minds and bodies. At the same time, all of those outside of the active labor force, owing to a given impairment, are likewise categorized as an undifferentiated disabled mass. A categorization that tells us absolutely nothing, of course, about the unique qualities of the disabled individual, other than that they are deemed unequipped for capitalist wage labor. Thus, the socially constructed separation of humans into fixed and exclusive disabled and non-disabled categories are merely two sides of the exact same coin. Okay. So I guess as a way of concluding, I think the conclusion then is that this mutually repressive state of affairs can only be addressed through a radical restructuring of the nature of production and distribution, and indeed a transformation in the nature of value itself. The production process should be and can be democratically adapted to the human laborers rather than forcing the human laborers to adapt to the predetermined production process. Distribution should be consciously mediated by human need rather than by a consumer market premised upon the reproduction of inequality. And humans should be valued according to their unique creativity, imagination, strengths, desires, and loves, rather than simply being a measure of the number of commodities an individual can produce at a profit above their wage for an employer in a given number of hours. As Martha Russell writes, In our society, humane concerns are subsumed by the market's tyranny, the inversion of what is needed to foster an inclusive, cooperative, and healthy society. Questions that need to be brought to the forefront might include the following. What is the purpose of an economy? To support market-driven profits, or to sustain social bonds and encourage human participation? Is it acceptable to reduce the productive activities of persons to commodity wage labor? Is it defensible to hold in contempt bodies that do not produce the way the capitalist class demands, leaving disabled persons to struggle on low wages or meager benefit checks, or to be institutionalized? How can the realm of work be reorganized to provide accommodations for all? And how can all members of society be embraced and rewarded, whether they work or not? In the end, the liberation of all of us depends upon the creation of a society organized around the simple saying coined by Marx and often repeated by Martha Russell, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.